Good morning. Thanks for coming to the last in this year's series. God willing, we have six dates set with topics for next year for a medical halacha series up here, as well as, God willing, a series down at Shari Shamayim. A little bit of a different makeup to the shiur that'll be down there, in the sense that for the one up here, we've really focused on making it not only a guide to practice, but also a shiur. So we work with the sources in Hebrew, and it's not presented in translation, and it's meant to be shiur-oriented the way that it started already now almost 2 years ago. I think the one down there will probably be also a little bit more open to people who have less in the way of background. And therefore, if you know someone who might be interested in that series, you know, let them know. God willing, that'll be next year. It'll be on Monday evenings there, six Monday evenings. And if you want the information for it, I'd be glad to get it to you as soon as I have it. But looking forward to that. And I really want to thank Laser, as well as Esther Libman, as well as Albert Kirshen, for doing the work of making the shiur possible, and in particular Albert's work for setting up the credits. I know that took quite a bit of time, and thank you very much for doing that. So, medical imaging on Shabbos. You see three vignettes in front of you on the sheet. We're actually not going to do as much as I wanted to on the third. The bulk of it is going to have to wait for a shiur at some other point in time, just because there's too much otherwise for us to cover. But let's go through them quickly. The first one. Alan, 11, is standing on the sidewalk on Shabbos when he is struck by a bicycle. He falls to the ground, suffers what seems to be a fractured wrist. May he undergo an x-ray on Shabbos? Does the answer change if he was struck by an automobile? Does the answer depend on whether this is a digital x-ray or on film? Thoughts on the vignettes first, on this first vignette. What do you think when you see it? Both in terms of what would you say is likely the rule, but also what reaction do you have? I already received a few reactions by email and modified it to suit the reactions I received. But what do you think of when you see this vignette? What questions need to be answered, perhaps?
Obvious.
I'm not dealing with right. If this is life or death, then the case is closed. Right. What else?
He's not doing it himself. The doctor is scanning.
Right. He's a patient. He's coming. We didn't word this as a question to the physician in particular. You could ask, well, he's Jewish, but he comes to the emergency room and some physician there is going to do it on his behalf, and he's just standing there. So that's a potential question. Another potential question is the difference between the bicycle and the automobile. It could be that when you look at it in terms of a bicycle accident, it may be cut and dry, and I'm not the physician, but it may be cut and dry that, yeah, it's a broken bone and not terribly traumatic, whereas the automobile, who knows what else is wrong inside. So theoretically, I stress theoretically, that could be an argument. The digital versus film, why might that matter?
It's an extra melacha to develop the film on Shabbat.
Is it? What about developing an x-ray?
You mean developing digital?
I don't mean developing, but showing it on a screen. Why would showing it on a screen be any different from printing it on paper?
It's LCD, and it's temporary versus something that's permanent.
Good. So part of the question is the permanence or lack thereof of the image. So those are all questions that we need to address. Take a look at number two, please. Susan, 56, and a lifelong non-smoker, presents in the emergency room on a Shabbos in midwinter with a bad cough, fever, and chest pains. The symptoms look like pneumonia. May the physician order an x-ray in order to rule out lung cancer? What about a CT scan? So what questions would you ask based on this vignette?
Can I wait till tomorrow?
Can I wait till tomorrow? Right. Does it really need to be done today? What else?
He may be doing an x-ray to assure yourself that it's pneumonia, may be considered pikuach nefesh, because if you don't treat a pneumonia, worse the person would die, depending on many things. As far as whether it's lung cancer, it's not going to make a difference if you diagnose it today or tomorrow in terms of saving your life.
Right. Good. What about the x-ray versus the...
I think it depends on the question of whether or not will the outcome of the imaging affect the treatment on Shabbat itself.
Right.
So you could say if it's a pulse, if there's a mass and there's a pulse that affects pneumonia, it might require different antibiotics than a typical community-acquired pneumonia.
Mm.
And in any case, without regard to lung cancer, if it's a typical or atypical pneumonia, you generally want to get an x-ray before you choose antibiotics.
Right, so even within pneumonia, it may affect the way that I treat. Okay.
For you, CT versus simple x-ray, if you're doing multiple imaging, so you're multiplying your
right, potentially it involves different activities and more activities. Yes?
I was going to say something different. What if this turns out to be something infectious and it's around to other people?
Mm.
It turns out to be TB or an active fungus or something else?
Right, see, I limited it to the sort of either or, but you're right. In an actual example, there may be more considerations than ones that I put in, than the ones that I put in here.
Sorry, John.
Good questions also. The answer is either. Who's Jewish in these scenarios? The patient, the physician, or both? So I'm looking at it really from the perspective of the patient first, but theoretically the physician, you know, the question will apply regarding the physician as well, who's instructing somebody to do it or who's actually doing it himself. So it could involve the physician, yeah.
The difference between a CT scan and an x-ray, I mean, the patient's passive in this, does it make a difference how the images? Whether it's an x-ray or a CT scan.
Right.
To the patient itself,
right.
He's lying there passively, does it make a difference how the images are taken?
Right, so theoretically, yes. In other words, if we're going to say that I'm liable for aiding someone to perform a malacha, or instructing him to perform a malacha, then I am liable 10 times if I aided to do that 10 times.
But the patient's not instructing.
I'm sorry?
The patient's not instructing.
Really? Why is the patient not instructing him to do it?
They're saying, I'm having this problem, then we have to get the diagnosis.
At any time in the last, I don't know, 15 years, 15 to 20 years, that I've had to have anything done, you know, any sort of procedure in a medical setting, I had to sign, if not one release, 10 releases, you know, and say, I asked you to do this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the whole question of signing releases, we talked about last year in writing on Shabbos and the question of how to do that. But I think that you could argue that these are multiple instructions coming from the patient to the physician. The third case is the one that I said at the outset we're not going to get to in great depth for reasons I'll now explain. But Janet, 35, is undergoing IVF, requiring ultrasounds on days 4 and 6 of her second week of injections. Assuming Janet can arrive at the hospital without violating Shabbat, may she have the actual ultrasound? I didn't want to get into the whole how is she getting to the hospital discussion. That's its own interesting discussion. There are really three issues within this case. The one issue within it is that in the case of the ultrasound, and it's certainly an intravaginal ultrasound, the patient is doing a lot more to make this possible than just standing in front of a screen. There are movements that the patient has to do in order to make this possible. That was one question. The second one is the use of gel in order to increase the conductivity of the ultrasound. But then there's a third issue, which is really the main issue that I wanted to get to here, which there's just no time for, unfortunately, this morning. So I gave you, if you look at the end of the sheet, a list of three articles, which I could actually, I think I can get them in digital form to email to people, because there's no time to cover them today. But the issue of whether we view someone who's undergoing fertility treatments trying to have a child as the equivalent of a chole, of someone who is ill. Or do we say, look, their life's not in danger, they're not suffering from a disease, it's just that they want to be able to have children. How do I view the priority for that in terms of doing things on Shabbos? It's a great question, but it's totally beyond the scope of what we're going to, what we're going to get to today. Okay, so let's start talking about the halachos involved. So as a preface, in order for us to get to all of this, I want to discuss the question of whether it's called writing when you display a film, when you take and display a digital picture. That's an important question that we need to address. So rule number one is that writing does not necessarily involve letters. Okay, the malacha, the prohibited form of work on Shabbos of writing, does not necessarily involve actually using letters that we would recognize as being of the alphabet. If you take a look at source Aleph, Mishnah says in Shabbos, HaKosev Shtei Osios, one who writes two letters, Bein Bimino, Bein Bismola, whether it is right or left hand, Bein Bishem Echad, Bein Bishtei Shemos, whether it's two of the same letter or two different letters, Bein Mishtei Samanios, uses two different materials, two different inks to write the letters, Bechol Lashon, in any language, any alphabet, Chayav, is liable. From there, it sounds like it's only the letters. If I make marks, draw pictures, I'm not liable for writing. However, Amar Rabbi Yossi said, Lo Chivu Shtei Osios Elamishum Roshem. He says, no. The only reason why we define writing as use of two letters is because you are making meaningful marks, what we call roshem. Lirshom is to make an impression. You're making meaningful marks on a surface. Shekach kosvin al karshei hamishkan, because the original form of this malacha, of this prohibited form of work, was that in the Mishkan, this traveling Beis Hamikdash, traveling temple the Jews had in the wilderness, you had beams. And on each beam, they would make marks, like furniture you get from IKEA to let you know, A is next to B, and B fits here into C. So that's what they did. You had beams, and you'd mark the beams so that each time you assembled it, you knew which beam was next to which. You weren't supposed to switch them around. The one that was in the northeast corner wasn't supposed to end up in the southwest corner. So you made marks for that purpose. This is a form of work that's done in maintaining the Mishkan, and it's not allowed on Shabbos. But for that, you don't need letters per se. Any intelligible mark, any mark you can discern, is going to count. So that's really our definition of writing on Shabbos. The Shekach Kosen on Kershe HaMishkan, this is how they wrote on the beams in the Mishkan, Leda Ezo Ben Zugo, in order to know which one was the match for the next, which board partnered with the next. And the Rambam indeed codifies this in Hilchos Shabbos, its source Beis. Roshem told us Kosev Hu. Roshem is a descendant form of writing, is the way he puts it. Roshem, making intelligible marks, is a form of the prohibited malacha of writing. Ketzad, how so? HaRoshem Rishmim Vitzuos Bekotel, one who makes marks and pictures on a wall, etc. I should note that not every type of a mark is going to carry liability. One of the key rules is that it has to be visible. The mark has to be visible. And Rav Gedalia Felder, in his Yisodei Yeshurin, made this point. It's in Chelek Hey. I didn't retype his material on here, but it's Chelek Hey, pages 45, 46, Mem Hey, Mem Vav. He says that if you use materials to imprint a code that's not visible to the eye, but it happens to be meaningful, so a machine would be able to process it and draw something from it, that's not called kosev. That's not called writing. So in other words, if I have take it out of the realm of the x-ray for a moment, but if you have an audio tape or a videotape and something gets recorded on that, that's not called kosev, even though intelligible symbols have been made on this material, you couldn't look at it and see it. The material doesn't look any different to us. It happens to be discernible by a machine. There may be other malachos involved. It's electric, it's whatever it is, but that's not kosev. So similarly, when a person takes an x-ray, and certainly a digital one, until it's developed, there's no picture for anybody to actually see. And therefore there's no malacha, there's no prohibited work involved. It's the developing that's going to run us into trouble. It's not the imprinting of something that's not visible on a plate in the first place.
What's the source again?
Yesodei Yeshurun Chelek Hey, Daf Mem Hey Mem Vav. So that's one piece we need to know. Visible marks that have meaning are prohibited under writing. However, you could make a very interesting argument that none of this should be a problem in any case. Even if they are visible marks and all that, and even if I develop it. We usually define writing as making a mark with some kind of a pen. Pen, pencil, stylus, whatever I'm doing. but there's some sort of a pen. There's a writing action that takes place. Right hand, left hand, ambidextrous, whatever. We even say that you're not liable if you write, or you're not liable biblically if you write in an abnormal way. We talked about this last year, the question of writing with one's left hand, for example. So why should someone be liable for taking an x-ray on Shabbos if there's no act of writing involved? Right? You expose a plate to x-rays that go through or bounce off of someone's skin, and then you press a button on something and it develops. Why is that writing at all? You can make the same argument for typing on a keyboard.
Well, the old tubes, I don't know about the new ones, we have to ask you about the new ones, but the old tubes you have to heat, like an incandescent, similarly to an incandescent bulb. So that would have been a malacha, you couldn't have done it.
Right, that's a lighting a fire question. And as I understand it, even this new technology they're talking about, I have to thank Michael Mirsky, he's not here right now, but I posted the vignettes on my blog online to see whether I could get feedback on the vignettes there. And he noted the development, or someone else noted the development of solid state x-rays. So the
radiologist asked him.
So from what I understand, they also involve heat cycling.
Because actually the generators, not so much the receiving of the vectors on the other side, but it's the generation of
it. Right. But from what I understand, it's automated. I mean, they don't want you leaving it on all Shabbos, but it's not like you're doing something to cycle that heat, from what I read.
No, but you push a button to
turn it on.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's all true in terms of the issue of heating it and using the electricity, but in terms of writing, my argument would be, this isn't an act of writing at all. That's not any writing I've ever seen. You just push a button. So could you make that argument? In fact, this is not a new issue. This is a very, very old issue. It goes back to the Yerushalmi. Not because anyone was taking x-rays in the Yerushalmi, nor was anyone pushing a button and using electrical current, but they were developing invisible ink. And they did it without an act of writing. In the Yerushalmi, it seems that what they did was they would write using some form of non-visible ink on a material, or a material that would be absorbed in the medium, in the paper, whatever it was, and then they would expose it to a chemical afterwards, and the ink that was used in writing would then be exposed. Later on in history, we of course find the development of heat. Use of heat for exposing ink, where you would do the old lemon juice, or as the Prima Gaudium has, unpasteurized milk. They would use to write on a piece of paper, and then they would expose it to heat, and that would expose it. So here again, you're writing, you're causing the exposure of text on a surface, and you're doing it without an act of taking your pen and passing it over the paper. Yes. Right.
You actually have to photocopy it. Most of the shops have to photocopy it. Because
right.
Because if you write something in a hospital and no one can read it for 24 hours, that's actually medically dangerous.
Yes. That's correct. That's something called a Shabbat that they developed. It's a little bit beyond the scope of this, because that's really a question of how should I write if I have the option of writing. But you're right that they developed it. I'm actually going to make reference to it in a little bit, or in a lot bit, in Source Yud Zayin. So if it's writing that's going to disappear, it's a derabanan. That would make it a derabanan.
I was going to say, I had one of those pens, and they last a little longer than 24 hours, so you have time after Shabbos to...
Right. There's some debate whether you have 24 hours, 72 hours, in terms of at what point it's no longer called permanent. But in terms of this, take a look, please, on your sheet at Source Gimel. The question doesn't come up only regarding Shabbos, the invisible ink question. It comes up also regarding a get. If someone writes a get with invisible ink, or with ink that's visible and then it disappears, and he gives the get to his wife, does that count as a valid get? That's actually the first case where it's brought up in the Gemara. Don't ask why someone would. If you ask questions like that, Gemara is not for you. But take a look at Source Gimel, the Prima Gaudium's comment on this issue. He says, "Va'osan ha'kosvim divrei seser b'niyar." People who write secret messages on paper, im chalav shenechlav avalonis bashel, with milk that was milked but was never heated up, never pasteurized. V'nivla b'niyar, it's absorbed in the paper. V'ein rishumo nikar, and the mark of it is not visible. Ukshebala chavero, and then he comes to his friend, he delivers the paper. No saying Oso Aitzel Ha'esh, he puts it on by the fire. Mishal Heves, the flame will mischamim, and it's heated up. Vinikarak Savahu, and the paper becomes recognizable, meaning the text becomes recognizable. And he, parentheses, Ayin B'Yerushalmi Kain, Zeh, he's referring to the Yerushalmi regarding Get, which actually is a different case that I'm going to come back to. Im Asa Kain B'Shabbos, if a person does that on Shabbos, when he says does that, what he's referring to is exposing the text, not writing the text in the first place, but exposing it. Yesh lomar dechiyuv chadas leka. You could say it's not biblically prohibited. Done at the time of the Beis Hamikdash, there's no liability to bring a sin offering. Umikomako midrabbanan aser, but it would be rabbinically prohibited to dummy lekose if it's like writing. The kol shekein b'makom shiyad seledes bo, certainly in a case where you're going to heat up the ink, if you're going to bring it too close to the flame, to the point where it reaches the magic 113 degrees Fahrenheit or so, at which point we say you're called cooking. So if you're going to heat up the ink to the point of cooking, that's a whole separate discussion. But he actually continues there to talk about paper having latent moisture in it, and therefore concerns in general for bringing paper near a flame. An interesting discussion in its own right. But the point for us from the Prima Gaddim is that here, because I'm not actually passing a writing implement over a piece of paper in order to produce the text, I'm simply bringing it near heat, and now the text emerges on its own. That's not called writing biblically. And therefore, to apply it to the x-ray case, the argument would be, I didn't make the picture in a normal way, I pushed a button, and it just developed. Or if the machine was already on, then I didn't even do that. The person just walked in front of it, and the picture came out. That's not writing. That would be the argument. We saw something like this when we discussed, I don't remember if it was this year or last year, I think it was last year, when we talked about, it was a different series. We talked about the issue of walking in front of a video camera on Shabbos, or walking in front of a security system camera. I'm not writing anything, even if it's recording an image, which most of them don't do at this point anyway. But even if it is recording something, that's not an act of writing on a biblical level. The Har Tzvi, who wrote Tzvi Pesach Frank, dealt with this question and asked, why exactly is it rabbinic? What exactly is the reason why this should be rabbinic? He was dealing with a question about erasing the name of God when it's not currently visible on a material, but it could be made visible. Which is, again, a separate issue, the issue of erasing. But for our purposes, this is important. Why is this rabbinic? The Har Tzvi asked. And he gives a few answers. One answer is, because as we just said, it's not called writing at all. And he gives me an example. An example from the Gemara of a person who puts materials in a mill on Shabbos. Okay? I have a mill. The mill is running on its own. It's operated by hydropower or something. But the mill is already running. So I take some grain and I put it in the mill and the mill grinds it up. I didn't do anything. I didn't start the mill going. I don't stop it from going. All I did was put in the materials. Not like what was the normal means of grinding something up, where you either used a hand mill that you would crank, or you had an animal or something that would push the larger upper stone. You had these two large stones, and you would push the upper stone around in a circle, and the everything would rest on the base, on the lower stone. That was your normal means of grinding up. So, am I liable if I put wheat into that mill on Shabbos? And the answer is, it's a debate. Surprise. It's a debate between the Eben HaOzer and the Magen Avraham. The Eben HaOzer said, yes, that's biblically prohibited. And he says, I'll prove it to you. The rule is that if I winnow on Shabbos by taking grain and throwing it up in the air, and the wind comes, and it blows the grain, and part of the grain that I want to use falls in one place, and the rest of the grain that I don't want to use falls in another place, because the chaff is lighter than the material that I want. So I am liable. So says the Gemara in Bava Kamma, Daf Samach. I am liable for winnowing when I throw up the grain, and it falls in these different ways. That's the Gemara. So he says, there, you didn't do anything. The wind is what did something, and yet you're liable. So too, if you put the wheat in the mill, and the mill grinds it on its own, you're going to be liable. And therefore, the argument would be, perhaps the same thing should be true regarding this invisible ink. To which the Magen Avraham, Rav Avraham Gambina, writing in the 17th century, said it's not true. This is not so. And the reason that it's not so is that the grain is ground on its own in the mill case. And he says, don't compare this to a case where the winnowing is done by the wind, because in grinding, normally you do the work. In other words, in the winnowing case, you are liable because that's the way winnowing is done. Winnowing is done with the wind. That's the way they normally did it. So therefore, if this is the normal means of doing something, then even though it didn't involve my personal action, I am still liable. In the grinding case, they normally ground things up with their own action, and therefore if they grind it up instead by putting it into a mill that's running on its own, they're not liable. So says the Magen Avraham in that discussion. And so, the Har Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, says let's look at the case of text that is exposed on its own, like the invisible ink. Or like, for our purposes, the X-ray. He says the argument would be, the argument of the Magen Avraham would be, this is not the normal way of producing writing. You don't normally produce writing by exposing paper to heat. You normally produce writing by writing things. And therefore, it's only rabbinic, the prohibition against exposing invisible ink, and we would like to borrow this for the X-ray, would be rabbinic rather than biblical. Esther?
Why wouldn't grain actually be mussa, just because it's not being, you don't need it for Shabbos? So why could...
Right, so they used to actually eat raw grain, not as a meal, but as a snack. The Gemara in Beitza talks about crushing individual kernels between your fingers and whether you're allowed to do that on Shabbos, because yeah, they would have it raw. You could also use it probably as animal feed, I would guess, but that's purely a guess. Yeah?
If somebody does both types of work, he does write through the milk and then develop it, wouldn't this be equivalent to making an expression?
Yes. The initial act of, well, maybe. I should say maybe. I would think the original act of writing would carry liability, but I'm going to show in a little bit that even that may not. So hang in there. It may not be so. The Rafelder, in the source that I quoted earlier, in his fifth volume in Yesoda Yeshurun, disagreed with relying on the Magen Avraham for this. And his reasoning was, first of all, he said most don't agree with the Magen Avraham. That was number one. And number two, he said, this is a normal means of writing. In other words, this is the way you do it. Now, he had two responses on the topic in his Yesoda Yeshurun. The one was on the issue of telegraphs. Same idea. You send an impulse, and then it makes, you know, the dots and the dashes that someone can interpret. But again, it's the machine that's making the dots and the dashes. And the other was regarding X-rays. And the argument was, but this is normal. This is what we do. We have devices. We use them every day. And they imprint. So even if it wasn't the way it was done in the Mishkan, it is still a normal way to do this. It reminds me, for those who were at the Techno Shabbos series that we had here last year, the Wednesday night series, we talked about the issue of cooking with chemicals on Shabbos. Cooking meaning, not meaning like salami, but cooking with chemicals in the sense of the chemical reactions. When you take the magnesium and or whatever it was, I don't remember anymore. But you expose one chemical to another, and that's causes an exothermic reaction, and now you can cook that way, even though you didn't light a fire. Are you liable for cooking? And one of the arguments that was made in the discussion was that at some point, this could be the normal form of cooking, such as if you're in the military, and that's the type of meal they give you, and every single day for your entire tour of duty, you're eating meals that are heated that way, maybe that becomes the normal form of eating food. Of heating up food. So that's the argument that he makes in response. So again, one reason why it might not be called writing is because it's not done with a writing implement, to which the response may be, this is still considered normal because we do it and we use it all the time. That's one. A second reason offered by the Har Tzvi to explain why it could be rabbinic is similar to the first, but not precisely the same, and that's that it's a shinui. you're writing in an abnormal way. This isn't the same thing as saying it's not called an act of writing. This is saying even if you're going to call this an act of writing, you're doing it in an abnormal way. This isn't the normal way of doing things. And he, of course, was talking about in the context of invisible ink. I think the argument is less valid regarding the X-ray. But the argument is, if you take a look at source Vav, Hakosei bismoa bismolo ola achar yado. A person writes with his left and he is a righty. Or he writes with the back of his hand. Biraglo, or he holds the pen in his foot. Or befiv, or in his mouth. Or marpeko, or in his elbow. Potter, he's exempt from liability. So the argument is that this would be considered an abnormal form of writing. There's more we could say with that, but I want to make sure to move on a little bit because there's quite a bit still to discuss. The Hartzvi also offers a third argument, which doesn't relate to our discussion because you're taking the X-ray on Shabbos, and it doesn't fit the paradigm. But I want to mention it just so that it's understood. He offers maybe invisible ink is unique because when you first write with the ink, that's called writing. In other words, you write down on the paper before it's absorbed in the paper, everybody can see the writing. So he says maybe it was called writing when you first wrote it down. It was absorbed in the paper, but it retained the status of text. And therefore causing it to reemerge is not a new act of writing. You're just causing someone to be able to see that which was written there before. It didn't lose its status as textbook when it was invisible. So therefore, causing it to be visible doesn't actually mean I did a new act of writing. It was already there. It's not like taking a pen and writing over existing text, where we do say that that's called writing. Here, I just caused text that was already there to become visible. And maybe that's why it's only rabbinic. That wouldn't work for the X-ray case. Yeah.
That way, you're just looking from a rabbanan rather than a...
Right. And he's only trying to explain the prima gaddim who said it was rabbinic. That's all he's going for. You're right, it's still rabbinically prohibited. No one in this is saying that it's permitted entirely. In fact, as a matter of the rulings on the issue, regarding telegraphs, the poskim tended to say that it was aser, the shut show elumeshiv, the marasham said it was aser. However, others say that this is a derabbanan, that it is in fact to be viewed as rabbinic. That matters a great deal. Because if I can get around the biblical concern, whether, you know, maybe electricity is considered a biblical concern, but maybe I can leave it on, or maybe it's on for a given period of time in the room every day, that they turn it on and it's not for me, some technician who isn't Jewish has it on for whatever period of time, if I can get away with having it on so I don't have to worry about the electricity issue, I've now reduced it to a derabanan. That's great, because the rule is that for a patient who is ill, even if he's not dangerously ill, I can do derabbanan on Shabbos. And especially if I get someone who isn't Jewish to do it, now it's a double derabbanan, because I'm asking someone who isn't Jewish to do something, that's one rabbinic prohibition, what I'm asking him to do is only rabbinically prohibited in the first place. So all the better. So therefore, it's to my advantage to be able to say that this is only a rabbinic consideration. The Minchas Yitzchak says it's a rabbinic prohibition. There are two unique leniencies on this, which actually come to say, you know what, it's entirely permitted. And I don't understand either of them, but I mention them because you can't give this shir without mentioning them. The first one is the Shut Shevet Halevi, Rushmuel Wozner. I brought him in Source Ches, but I'm going to do it quickly because we're already half an hour in. And that is, he says, you're not actually writing at all, in any way, shape, or form. You know what you're doing? You're removing an obstruction. His argument is the machine is cycling and the X-rays are flowing, and all you are doing at most is by removing whatever lead or whatever they use to block it from receiving things, you are causing it to be able to receive an imprint. But you didn't actually do anything actively to put an imprint on the plate. That's his argument. It's a fascinating argument. No one else says it. But it's a fascinating argument. You didn't write anything. All you did was remove an obstruction that allowed the writing to take place. That's one argument. So he says it's not even a derabbanan. It's not like the invisible ink, where you did something to it in order to make the text visible. The other argument for saying it's permitted is Rav Moshe Stern, in his Be'er Moshe, and if anyone wants the reference, I can give you the reference later. It's in his Kuntres Electric, which is a great name for... Anyway, he says, you know why it's not writing? because it's only comprehensible to an expert. I thought that was strange. I haven't seen anyone else present this point of view. I mean, it's true. I remember looking at the ultrasound for you know our first pregnancy and thinking, what is that? You're telling me that means something, but I don't know what you're looking at. But the truth of the matter is that anyone who looks at these things, you know, first of all, before that, I don't know why writing is only called writing if you need to be an expert to understand it. Why does that make it, you know, not writing? But number two, in general, you can see things, and even if you can't, you know, even if a layman looking at it can't discern what an expert can discern, you can tell that's a bone. I don't know why that would be contingent on someone looking at it being able to interpret it. But I mention it because it comes from Rav Moshe Stern, who's generally considered a pretty prominent authority. Yeah, Albert mentioned before that even if it's not writing, it could be something else. And that's true. Theoretically, you could argue that it should be coloring. Soveya. There's a prohibition against coloring things on Shabbos. Why is it not coloring? So the Menachas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, explains why it's not called coloring in source tests. He says, B'tshuvos Karen LeDavid, Sham Kasav, Pshitos Le'in, Amitzayer, Tzura, Al Yedei Photographia. If you ever wanted to know how to write photography in Hebrew, there you go. The answer is P-H-O-T-O. The Chayav Mishum told of the Kosev. He says, quotes a work, the Karen LeDavid, who says, straightforward, that taking a picture on Shabbos is a tolda of writing. It appears to be obvious that it's not called an issue of coloring. Why not? He says coloring is when you color wool. Something like that along those lines, because that's where it was done initially. And the Mishkan was to color materials, to dye things. Your goal is the material should acquire the color. But if your concern is not, I want the materials to be colored a certain thing, I just want to be able to see certain outlines. It's the shape, the outline that I'm concerned about, not the coloring that it takes on. Ein ze begeder tzoveya. That's not called coloring. Which is it's a good point, because ordinarily you should argue writing is always coloring. Right? I'm always coloring the medium on which I write. But he says, if your concern is for color, then it's coloring. If your concern is there a shape that conveys a certain message, then it's writing. So that's why he says it's not a coloring issue. I actually wonder about that, because not being a radiologist, but playing one on TV, I know that you do sometimes discern from different shades. You'll discern certain things. And it's not about the outline of it, it's actually about how dark this is or how light that is. So I wonder about that in his analysis. But in Source Yud, on the other side, Rav Wozner has a separate concern. His concern there is makah b'patish. Makah b'patish, literally hitting something with a hammer, is when you take something and make it functional. It was not functional before, and now it is functional. Right? Like when you hit your computer with a hammer, and now it's functional. It's sort of a catch-all, makah b'patish. When I have some action that I know shouldn't be permitted on Shabbos, but I can't fit it into one of the other 39 malachos, the 38 other malachos, then it's makah b'patish. It's taking something that wasn't functional and making it functional. And by the way, that's not a glib statement of it. That's actually in the sources. It must be makah b'patish. And Rav Wozner says that in Source Yud, that if I take a plate and I develop it, he's talking not about digital, he's talking about taking film and developing film. So he says, Omnam ze pashut etzli, he says, it's obvious to me, d'va'asiyas ha'tzmuna b'mayim, that when you take the film and you put it in a liquid in order to develop it, they have it in a chemical bath, the old way of developing film, he says, when they put the film into the liquid and then they rub it, the rubbing that they do, there's a biblical prohibition of striking it with a hammer, because that is the completion and fixing of the material. He says, there's no greater act of repairing something or fixing something than changing this blank piece of film into, or paper really, into something that will suddenly show a useful image. So that's another argument as to what's involved. Maybe you'll tell me that it's not writing, but maybe it's makiv patish when you develop film. In sum, regarding this segment, and this was the major segment that we had to see. The rest actually is much more straightforward. It does seem to be called writing midrabanan when one takes such a picture rather than d'oraisa. That seems to be the consensus. So Beya is not really cited as an issue. Coloring does not tend to be cited, and makiv patish is not going to apply, certainly when you're dealing with a digital image. If you were actually developing film, the argument could be made regarding makiv patish that you take the film and actually make the film usable. Make the paper, I should say, usable. And therefore, it would seem that our preference would be for the digital rather than for the film. Or if you're going to use the paper, then you do that after Shabbos rather than on, to avoid the makiv patish issue. Again, I should have stressed this at the outset. That's a slip, not doing that this time at the outset. I usually say it in the beginning, but I'll say it now. For all practical matters, please consult your shul rabbi. I'm only just offering education in the issues that are involved. Okay, that's all under the writing issue. There's a second issue, just as important as the writing issue, but easier to analyze, and that's the question of what's the extent of my involvement if I am the patient, or even if I'm the physician, and I'm instructing some technician to actually do this. Am I liable at all? Even if it is my instruction. So remember the rules of Amira La'akum. Amira La'akum is the prohibition against telling someone who isn't Jewish to do something for me on Shabbos. And the rule is, I am not allowed to tell someone who isn't Jewish to do something for me on Shabbos. It is a rabbinic prohibition. I am allowed to hint to him before Shabbos about things that I want him to do on Shabbos. That's the extent to which I am allowed to do things. I can't hint on Shabbos. I know there's a popular conception that you're allowed to hint to people on Shabbos. In a case of great need, such as the house is freezing and there's someone who's going to get sick or something like that, then there are leniencies for hinting to them on Shabbos. That's true. But ordinarily, I'm not allowed to do that.
What if you bring on Shabbos early in that period of time?
What about the period of time when you've accepted Shabbos at 7-something and Shabbos isn't going to start till 8-something? Then there's definitely room for more leniencies there. At that point, there's certainly room for more. Frankly, there's even room for leniencies in talking to a Jew who hasn't accepted Shabbos in that time frame. But on Shabbos itself, the rule is I can't indicate to him that I want him to do it unless it's something for his sake also. Which is an argument that's made regarding the technician sometimes. It's his job. He's doing it because he has a job to do. His job is to run the x-ray machine on Shabbos. I've seen that argument made in completely different contexts. There's a summer camp, and the summer camp has all sorts of buildings on which it needs the lights to be on Shabbos morning. They don't want to leave them all on Friday night. So they tell the custodian, you know, we're going to be using this building, and the custodian goes in and turns it on. Well, how did I tell him to do that? I'm hinting to him on Shabbos for him to do it. Yeah, but it's the custodian's job to always make sure that everything is set up the way everybody needs it. So he's really doing it for himself. Not ideal, but the hazard does exist.
Yeah, as I understand it, there is a difference. If something's impossible, doesn't exist, and you have between something that's only making things easier for you to do. So if the room is completely pitch black, you can't see anything, then the hazard of hinting to God might not exist. If the room is just dark, but you can sort of make things out, except it's just really hard, then that's what you have to for.
Interesting. I hadn't heard that. That's an interesting idea. I'd like to say, do you have any source of it? That's an interesting idea. I'm not familiar with it. Whether we would distinguish between where the room was pitch black and now he's making it usable at all, versus where the room was somewhat usable and he's just making it easier for you to use.
I think there was supposed to be a different room. Because you can technically speaking still read and still do the review, so he's not actually enabling it.
Right, but why would I be allowed to have him do malacha? That's what I don't get. Even if it's less useful for me, I should. What I'm thinking of on what you're saying is not quite about the way you're putting it, but about my ability to use the room afterwards. In other words, I didn't tell him to do anything. He turned on the light for me on Shabbos. If the room wasn't usable for me at all beforehand, then I wouldn't be allowed to benefit. If the room was usable but not ideal, then I would be allowed to benefit from it. That's what I'm thinking of, but I want to get back to this a little bit. Yeah.
With the patient, we're talking about the patient giving instructions to the technician, but the patient wouldn't be. It would be the doctor who's ordering the x-ray, and it would be the technician telling the patient where to stand, not the patient giving instructions or either outwardly or hinting. So in that case, is the patient liable?
Right.
And so then you get into that, well, if the doctor is Jewish or not Jewish, mm-hmm. you know, does it make a difference?
Right. The thing is that there really is explicit permission. Meaning I have to go through all sorts of releases, where I exonerate them from anything and everything before they're willing to do anything for me in the hospital. Whether it's this physician or whether it's the technician, he's going to tell them to do the machine. Either way.
No.
No.
Not in Canada.
Really?
Just one.
If it's an invasive procedure, yes. If it's something like an x-ray, unless things have changed since I've worked in the hospital, you don't sign release.
Okay.
What you may sign is when you come in that you agree to be treated that you agree to have your record sent to your family doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether that can be made.
Interesting. So maybe it's just because I come from the land of litigation. That could be why. Yeah, I mean, Rav Felder's position on this in his Yisodei Yeshurun, where he talks about this issue, he talks about it in Chelek Hey. It's actually different from the reference before. It's pages 84 to 86. This is where he does the x-ray discussion. He argues that standing in front of the machine for the non-Jew to then operate it is just as bad as telling him to write. He said he views it as the equivalent of telling him to write. Now, I have to note that even if it is Amira La'akum, remember that Amira La'akum, telling someone who isn't Jewish to do things for you on Shabbos, is still a derabbanan. It's rabbinic. So once again, the level of need necessary in order to justify it is reduced. There is a more substantive concern, though. Yeah?
Why is that Amira La'akum? Not saying anything?
Yeah, he views it as telling, but I definitely hear the argument that it should be hinting. Yes. Yes, and therefore you'll argue it should be speech. That's his argument, yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting argument, but he takes it as a given. He doesn't even justify it. He says, well, of course this is Amir al-Hakam. Yeah. The more substantive issue, and the one that's potentially biblical, is what we call Misayaya. Physically helping someone to do something that's prohibited on Shabbos. Am I liable for aiding him in doing this? So if you take a look on your sheet, you see two apparently conflicting passages of Gemara. Source Yud Aleph talks about receiving an eye treatment on Shabbos. Amemar permitted, it's Source Yud Aleph, I'm going to do it outside because it's already getting a little bit late and I haven't actually answered the vignettes yet. The Gemara in Beitza has Amemar, one of the sages of the Gemara's time, permitting coloring an eye on Shabbos. Coloring an eye was a form of treating the eye. They used a colored medicinal thing of some kind. It was alcohol-based. It was called kuchla. You know, I think we've discussed before, alcohol is an Arabic term. Al-kuchla is what it comes from. They had an alcohol-based topical treatment that they used, among other things, to treat something in the eye. I don't know what happens when you put alcohol in your eyes. I'm guessing it's not good, but that's what they did. But in any case, it also was used as an eyeshadow of sorts because of that color. So Amemar permitted taking that kind of a treatment from someone who wasn't Jewish on Shabbos. And he's challenged in Source Yud Aleph, how could you do that? Why isn't that problematic? You are Misayaya, you're helping him. You shift, you open your eye, you close your eye. You're involved physically in making this happen. So his answer was, Misayaya ain bo mamash. aiding in the act is not called a substantive thing. That's not called, even though it's true, I shift, I turn to make it easier for him, that's not called substantive malacha. That's Amemar's argument in Sursiyat Aleph. On the other hand, Sursiyat Beis talks about a completely different issue. Giving someone a haircut. And the rule is that males are not allowed to do what's called makiv, to cut their hair straight across here. It's a biblical prohibition that one is not allowed, a male is not allowed to cut his hair straight across. See the Rambam for explanations about why this is so, but it's so. Lo sakifu pa'as roshchem. So the question is, what if I go to a non-Jewish barber and he cuts it for me? Am I violating a prohibition? And the Gemara says yes. The Gemara says that's called nikaf, being cut by somebody, and based on the wording of the Torah's presentation of the mitzvah, not only am I not allowed to cut, I'm also not allowed to be cut in that way. And there they talk about the person sits down in front of the barber and says, well, what action has he done? And the answer is, he is misayaya. He is helping the barber because he turns. The barber says, turn your head this way, hold your head that way. Then he is liable. So now I have a problem. In Sursiyat Aleph, you told me that turning or misayaya helping is not a problem. In Sursiyat Bet, you told me that misayaya is a problem. Make up your mind. So the answer is, we can make up our mind, but we have two different ways to make up our mind. It's a machlokes. The Taz, I brought it here in Yud Gimel, I gave you just a fast, you know, three-word summary. The view of the Taz is it depends how much helping you're doing. He says, in the case of the barber, where you're liable, you do a lot more action than in the case of the eye treatment where you do less action. All you do is maybe open your eye, close your eye, it's not as visible and therefore not as substantive. Whereas in the case of the haircut, you really do a lot of movement. If we accept the Taz as an explanation for where misayaya matters and where it doesn't, I could argue that an x-ray, I don't really do anything discernible. I stand in a certain spot, I lie in a certain spot, then it's over. It's much more like the eye treatment than it is the constant shifting of the head for him to be able to cut.
You often change positions for different views.
That's true. I guess it depends to a certain extent on what type of an x-ray it's going to be. I could hear that. That's one take. The other take, though, is by the Shach in his work Nikudav HaKesef on the Shulchan Aruch. It's there, the second half of Sosyud Gimel. He says, no, it's not about how involved you are. Rather, the rule that I'm liable for helping is unique to the haircut case, because there the Torah says you're liable even if someone else cuts your hair. So therefore, you're liable. But in the normal scheme of things, no matter how much help you give, if you're not the one carrying it out, you're not liable. And so, in the case of the x-ray, I would not be called misayaya no matter how much work I did. It doesn't matter what I did. I would not be liable, according to the Shach in his Nekudas HaKesef. So, applying this to the x-ray, the CT scan, or the ultrasound, for that matter, is going to depend on how I go about this. Do I take the Taz's approach? In which case, it depends how helpful I am. Or do I take the Shach's approach in his Nekudas HaKesef, in which case I'm always going to be exempt from liability? It's possible, if I take the approach of the Shach, it's possible to argue that this is indeed only a derabbanan, maybe of Amir al-Akum, of telling him to do it. It may not even be that, if the doctor is in fact the one prescribing this and all the patient is doing is following instructions. You told me to stand over here, I'm standing over here, but I'm not the one telling the technician to do anything at all. So I can really then reduce the degree of liability. So now let's look at our vignettes. Now that we've addressed writing and shown that it could be argued that the writing, it really is likely, it's a derabanan, because it's pushing a button rather than actually writing something, unless you're talking about developing film with paper, in which case we may have greater problems. And showing that it may be Amir al-Akum, it might be Amir al-Akum telling him to do things, but we certainly have room for leniency in terms of misayaya, in terms of helping him with the action. We go back to the question of the broken bone. So the first question that's unique to this vignette is the question of how I view the danger to a person who has a potential broken bone. The Shulchan Aruch gives the following rule. Take a look at Source Yadalid, please. Chole shenafal machmas cholyo lemishka ve'ein bo sakana. Okay? A person who becomes bedridden, but has no danger. So for a Jew to break Shabbos in a rabbinically prohibited way, but actively so, for a Jew to actively break Shabbos on a rabbinic level, yesh matirim, some permit it, afilu ein bo sakanas eiver, some permit that even if there is no danger to a limb. Just in general, the Jew is bedridden, he has a high fever or something, you can do derabbanans on Shabbos in order to help him. That's his first view. Second, v'yesh omrim, some say, shem yesh bo sakanas eiver, that if there's danger to a limb, I'm using limb loosely, it's not really the best translation of eiver, but if there's danger to a limb, osin, then you're allowed to violate, v'mein bo sakanas eiver ein osin, but for anything less, you could not violate Shabbos. V'yesh omrim, and some say, shem ein bo sakanas eiver osin b'shinui, that if there is no danger to a limb, you could do it in an abnormal way. Vim yesh bo sakanas eiver osin b'lo shinui, and if there's danger to a limb, you do it straight, even without changing it in any way. You do it the normal way. V'yesh omrim, and some say, afilu yesh bo sakanas eiver ein osin lo davar shu nismach l'malacha del reisa, that even if there's danger to a limb, we don't do anything that is quasi-biblical, that's close to a biblical prohibition. Udram she'ein ben smach malacha osin afilu ein bo sakanas eiver. And if it's not similar to a biblical prohibition, then you can do it even without danger to a limb. This is good and confusing, right? This sounds sort of like the answer you get from your rabbi ordinarily, right? Well, some say this, and some say that, and by the time I'm done, I know that some say everything, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But the Shulchan Aruch isn't just like all of us. The Shulchan Aruch actually comes to a conclusion. V'divrei ha-svara ha-shlishi is nir'in. He says, it appears to me that the third view is the correct one. So now we just need to learn to count. Which one was the third view? That's harder than it seems, but the answer is that the third view is that if there is danger to a limb, then you do it even without a shinui, even not in an abnormal way. You can do whatever malacha it is, violating the derabbanan in the normal way. This is as opposed to danger to a life. So it appears. Now, there's a great question on this, which I'm not going to do right now, just because of how late it is. If anyone can stick around at the end, remind me, and I'm going to come back to a very interesting question on this point. But for now, I'm gonna hold it. It sounds like from the Shulchan Aruch, danger to a limb, such as the fractured bone, needs to be treated today, and I need to know how to treat it. So I have license to do derabbanans, but I wouldn't have license to do deoraisas. However, and this is the key. The poskim tend to leave a lot to the specifics of the medical diagnosis. On the one hand, I must admit, there is a native mistrust for the physician, because the physician goes into his trade as a physician seeking to, of all things, heal people. And that tends to be the physician's bias. And therefore, the physician will say, look, let me just do what I do. This is how I treat people. This is how I heal people. And in some cases, where you're dealing with a physician who doesn't have such a high respect for Shabbos, may say, don't bother me with your Shabbos stuff. Let me just do my job. Having said that, the accounts I've heard from Rabbanim, so to speak, in the field, and certainly this was my experience when I was in the field, is that we generally consider any break to be a life-threatening thing. Because of the concern that it could press on a blood vessel and cause some kind of additional damage inside, we tend to view this as fairly dangerous. When I gave you the distinction between the bicycle accident and the car accident, it's because as the incident becomes more severe and more traumatic, it becomes more clear that you say, look, I don't know what else is going on inside. It may be obvious to me that this is just a broken bone and there's nothing else wrong and I'll be able to set it and be fine. But we tend to be more lenient in that regard. That's been my experience. If others here have other experience, tell me. But that's been my experience. Is that in practice we do the X-ray. Yes, we'd like to do it in an abnormal way. Yes, we'd like to have a non-Jew be the technician who's running it. Yes, we'd like to be as involved as little as possible and do digital rather than developing a film. But we do go through with the it.
And, I see where you're coming from. If a kid comes in with what looks like a fracture, he fell off his bike, or he got hit by a bike, or hit by a car, I'm not sure that would make much difference. It doesn't look very good.
Right.
It bent. I'm not sure how it happened with that. You know, we
just because of the question of whatever physical event this was, and there you're talking about a case where I don't know what happened, but if I know what happened, then it doesn't seem like it should have been strong enough to actually do anything further. That would be the argument.
So it's equivalent. It doesn't look that bad. You're wondering, whereas if I hit by a car, it doesn't look that bad. You might say, you know, if you hit by a car, maybe something nice.
Yeah.
So,
also, depends on the issue of the person, especially age.
Yeah. Right.
They don't heal as fast. And even if it looks simple, at a certain age, it's no slightest thing could be really dangerous.
Right. That's true. I mean, a lot does depend on the specific circumstance of the patient. You mentioned age as a factor. Frankly, I might mention a whole other factor. If you think that the incident was mild and really shouldn't have caused anything, then you have to ask yourself, well, wait a minute, then why did the bone break? What else might be wrong here? What else might be involved? But I leave that to the physicians. There's also an additional heter for digital technology. When you're dealing with the digital thing, and that is, the Rambam writes, it's in source Tesvav on your sheet, that you're only liable if you make a mark that actually endures on a material. And the Avnei Nezer makes this point. I wrote a line from his tshuva in source Ted Zion in the invisible ink discussion. The Avnei Nezer writes that text which will be absorbed in paper but could then be removed by a candle's heat is fully called writing. It's called enduring text because you could always bring it back, even though right now it's not visible. So I might have argued the same thing is true when you take your x-ray, because you could always develop it. However, the Nishmas Avram, Rav Avram Sofer Avram, says no, because in the case of the invisible ink, it was visible when you started. This goes back to the point you made in the beginning. When you made the invisible ink, it was actually visible at the start, and then it became invisible, and then it could be produced. In the x-ray case, the marks that it's making are not visible from the get-go. It's only once you develop it that it's actually going to be visible. And that's reason to say it may not be called writing. It's an added note on this. I also brought you here in Source Yud Zayin the note from Tzomet. I mentioned this in a shiur last year, which says, "Im kaimot shtei asharyot shkulot, if there are two equal options available, ksiva be'eit Shabbat, as they call it here, mitnadef, writing with a Shabbos pen, in which the ink is going to disappear, o b'machshev, or writing with a computer, yesh laha'adif machshev." He says, "I prefer the computer over that. Im lo nidreshet hadpasa, if you're not going to need to print it out on paper." Because I not need to print out paper now. Haksiva b'machshev eina kinena ksiva klal al rishumim elektroniyim o electromagnetiyim. Because he says it's not writing. All you're doing is causing impulses to appear on the screen. It's not durable. So that's another reason why digital is better than film. Because ultimately, it's not called writing if it's something that's constantly regenerating on the screen. That's the argument. Yes.
It may not be writing, but what about the electrical impulses that you're causing to occur, and when the writing appears on the screen?
Right. I always wondered about that. I think I asked that actually when I used this last time. I asked, well, what about every time you hit the key on the keyboard? Why is that not an issue? The only answer I can give is that Tzomet must view electricity as a derabbanan. And the equivalent, therefore, of use of the pen to write with the disappearing ink. That's the only answer that I can give. You're right. I don't understand why they wouldn't say I'm modifying and connecting circuits in order to do this.
Because there's no real heat involved. It's all solid state.
Circuits.
Yeah. Right. So maybe that's the argument. I mean, it's only abundant in terms of havara, in terms of lighting a fire. What if I take the Chazanisha stance that it's construction? I mean, that's beyond the. It's not really what we're here today to discuss. It's an interesting question. Chazanisha's stance is not easily understood, but that's another thing. But that's number one on this. So that Rafelder writing in his Yisoda Yeshurun permitted an X-ray for someone who had danger to a limb. The Nishmas Avram says if there's a serious break, you're allowed to do it. He says turn off the machine with someone who was in Jewish or with a Shinoi in some abnormal way. Ditto for how one would turn it on. The ideal would be if it's on the whole time. That would be the best. The Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe Stern, says if there's concern for damage to blood vessels, you do it even with a Jew. Don't go looking for someone who was in Jewish dafka in order to do it. Ideally, do it in an abnormal way. The Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa says if there's danger or possible danger, ideally the screen should be lit before Shabbos. They all basically carry the same theme, which is if you think this is dangerous to life, just do it. If you think that it's not dangerous to life, so, you know, ask someone who was in Jewish rather than do it yourself. You should, ideally, it should be a screen that's on for other reasons rather than for this. But the standard for is this dangerous to life really is up to the diagnosis on the scene. And we trust someone who cares about Shabbos to give us the right answer about just how to evaluate the harm. Clear on vignette one? Okay. Vignette number two is actually more straightforward once we've gone through all of that. And that's the question of the treatment of Susan, the lifelong non-smoker who presents in the emergency room. And really the question that I want to add here, which we haven't discussed yet, is the question of standard procedure. If you take a look at Source Yud Ches, the Shulchan Aruch writes the following, Maka shel chalal eina tzricha omed. He says, when dealing with an internal disease, wound, whatever it is, you don't need to evaluate it, meaning to say, do I need to treat this, do I not need to treat this or not, assume you need to treat. Even if there are no experts on scene, and the patient doesn't say, I need this, we do whatever the standard is, or whatever the standard treatment is anyway on his behalf. You do for him whatever you would do for him if it was Tuesday. That's the psak. In other words, a patient comes in. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert. I don't know what to do. I know this is the normal thing that people do for a person in this situation. The patient isn't saying anything. I don't have experts who can analyze it. I don't even have it. It's internal, so I have no way to know from where I am. So do whatever they normally do for people in this shape. And if it involves violating Shabbos, that's what you do.
Halal means internal?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the usage here. So that's what the Shulchan Aruch says that one would do. He's quoting the Ramban in his Taras HaAdam. If you take a look at the Mishnah Brura on that in Source Yates, he says, Umashma, it sounds like from here, Af al pi she'ein bo sakana b'mnias hadavar hahu, even though there is no danger in withholding that treatment. Kevin shacholi yesh bo sakana, since he has a dangerous ailment in general, v'yesh ba'davar tzarech tzas, and there is some need for it, or regilin lasos lo b'chol, and they do normally do this for him during the week, osin gam b'shabbos, you do it on Shabbos. As long as there is some level of need, and you are treating an illness which has some danger, you do on Shabbos what you would do during the week. So if on Tuesday you would recommend such and such an exam, the exam isn't saving his life, but the exam is to treat a disease that could be dangerous to him, then you do it on Shabbos also. That's the argument presented in the Shulchan Aruch, presented in the Mishnah Brura, quoting the Ramban. So the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram, quoting Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, who's the author of the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, says that if a patient presents with some kind of a lung condition, they're coughing or whatever, they have a fever and so on, it seems obvious to the physician that the patient has pneumonia, nonetheless, and leaving aside the question of will that change the way I treat the pneumonia, the view of the Nishmas Avram is you always x-ray, even if it's obvious. You would x-ray him on Tuesday, you x-ray him on Shabbos. You don't say, well, let me wait till after Shabbos to do it. You give him you do the x-ray now. So that's the question now. What if this physician has a personal practice of doing something that isn't ordinary? What if this physician always says, I always order a CAT scan because I want to rule it out? And I'd like to do it, therefore, even though it's Shabbos. I know it's not necessary. I know that no one else requires it. I know that it could wait, but this is my normal protocol. Is the Shulchan Aruch here licensing me to do my personal normal protocol? So Eliezer Waldenberg says no. If you take a look at Source Chaf, he says, Masha Mekil Larova, he's speaking about, he's writing a response to a work called Lev Avram. by, I think it's Avraham Sofer Avraham. It's either that or Avraham Steinberg. It's Avram Avram. Okay. He writes in response to Avram Sofer Avram. He says, Mashemekel l'rofe lahatir lo lasas tzilum rentgen b'shabas l'chole. That which he was lenient in the Lev Avram to permit the doctor to do a rentgen. Rentgen is an x-ray. I always love it when I see that. The rentgen. Someone should honor the man who actually came up with it. We call it an x-ray. Who's X? This leniency of permitting him to do the rentgen on Shabbos for the patient, kol shedarko shel rofei zeh b'kach gam b'yimei hachol, where this doctor always does it during the week, v'afilu b'mikra baruru pashut, and he always does it even if it's obvious. He still orders the x-ray. U'mitzayin k'makor l'kach l'shulchan aruch l'mishneh berurah, and he quotes what we saw in Yud-Ches and Yud-Tes as his source. L'dati asur ha-davar. To me, this is prohibited. Vein hanidon dome l'raya. He says, your case is not like the source that you're using as proof. Disham b'shulchan aruch u'mishneh berurah. In that case, in the shulchan aruch and the mishneh berurah, hamadur b'kol sheregilim u'mekubal ha-davar. Lazus kein bimos hachol. He says, the shulchan aruch is talking about something which everybody normally does during the week. Kidamud gash bilashon, as is emphasized in the language, kol sheregilim lasos lo b'chol, as something which everybody does during the week. Regilim, it's normal. V'rak az yitachin lahakel b'davar, then you could be lenient, possibly, aval bishein bo sakana b'minias ha-davar ahu, even though we didn't see any danger in waiting till after Shabbos. Kevin shachol yish bo mias sakana, because there is danger in the illness. Vein aval alavo velilmod mizel hakel gam avur darko shel rofe ze bilvad. La says kein gam bimos hachol. He says you don't say based on that we should be lenient where it's this physician's practice to be lenient during the week. Bizman she'etzel klal harof im barur she'em bedchias hatzilum al kapanim admot zay shabbos kodesh shum chash agras hasakana. If most physicians would tell you there's no problem with waiting until after Shabbos, it's not going to get any worse between now and then. And even practically this physician agrees b'davar in the matter shamikra barur or pashut, that really it's clear, and he's only doing it because of some concern that's not really founded in reality. V'odzos, and further, he says, "Da'filu b'ha'id the kol sheregilim." Even when we say you can do whatever is normal, misayim gam kena mishneh berurah be'atzmo shama v'kosev. The mishneh berurah himself finishes off by saying, "Because those in a case like this, the aval kol sheberur she'ein b'minias osa davar chash sakana." That if it's clear, there's no danger in withholding it. Even though he does need it, or again, when they do normally do it, you would not do it on Shabbos with a Jew. You would have someone who isn't Jewish do it. Like the needs of a patient who is not dangerously ill. So the Tzitz Eliezer's position is, if the practice of doing this test or this X-ray is unique to that physician, he's the only one who does it. And even he acknowledges, I'm not ordering it because I think there's a danger. I'm just doing it because I want to be on the safe side. I want to touch all the bases, whatever. If that's his only reason for doing it, then wait till after Shabbos. If he thinks there's a concern, and he just thinks all the other physicians are wrong, he says, in my experience, I've seen this develop into something else, and therefore, you need to do it, then he's going to be okay. He'll say, all right, then we have something to talk about. But if he's just doing it because he wants to be safe, and really he knows he could wait till after Shabbos, and he acknowledges that, then he says, I have no grounds for saying, follow your personal practice and order it. So as a matter of practice, we say, if it's routine for everybody to do this, then even if it's not a matter of life and death, as long as you're dealing with an ailment that we consider serious, and pneumonia we consider to be a very serious ailment, then you would order the routine tests on Shabbos. That's vignette number two. I said I wasn't going to get to vignette number three, and I'm correct. I'm not going to get to vignette number three. The three big questions you have to ask are the level of interaction with the technician, which we saw in that Taz versus the Shach. Am I liable for Misayaya, for aiding him or not? The same answer that we gave there is the answer we'll give here. The second question is the gel the ultrasound gel. The Shemir Shabbos Kehilchasa says a liquid should be used rather than a gel. It should be something that flows because of concerns from a mareach for shmiring it. The Nishmas Avram actually disagrees and says, no, you could use a gel. It's chelek hay. Page 163 in Chelek Hay in the Nishmas Avram. And then the third issue, and really the big issue, is what is the halachic weight of fertility treatments such that it would override Shabbos? And it's a great discussion that, God willing, we will have to have at some point in the future. But I did give you the reference to three articles there that are very worth seeing. Yes?
We had a lot before talked about how much you can do on Shabbos if someone's very emotionally distraught.
Yeah.
So that would probably be a big thing.
Very much a factor. Agreed. As well as the fact that we call Puruvu a mitzvah rabba. That's not considered, Puruvu is not considered a normal mitzvah. It's considered to be an overarching one, but it's not incumbent on her, it's not incumbent on him. And yeah, there's a lot to discuss in this. Or there wouldn't be three articles on it, there would be one. Yeah. All right? Are we clear? The summary's good. Thank you very much then. Albert, what's...
I realized after finishing the shiur that we never went back to the point that I skipped and said I could throw in at the end, so I'll do it now, and at least for those recording, those downloading the audio, you'll get it. We talked about Sakanas Eiver, the question of violating Shabbos in order to save a limb, and we noted that the Shulchan Aruch concludes that you could violate a Derabanan in order to save a limb for Sakanas Eiver, even if even without a shinui. So the problem with this is that the Shach in Yeridea Kuf Nun Zayin Sif Katan Gimel says that if one is in danger because he's being attacked, and someone is trying to kill him, and someone says to him, I'm sorry, I presented that case wrong, let's try that again. If a person's limb is in danger from an anus, from an attacker, we say that he's allowed to violate not only derabanans, but even deraisas, in order to save it from the attacker. So why is it that when it comes to an attack, you're allowed to violate deraisas, but for medicine on Shabbos, we say you're only allowed to violate derabanans to save the aver, to save the limb? So Rafelder, and as he said, the Yeshur and Chelek Dalet, it's page 253, answers that in the medical case, you actually want to violate Shabbos. You want to do this thing that you're doing that is illegal, and therefore it's aser unless you're doing it derabanan. Whereas in the anas case, in the case where you're being attacked, you don't want to violate Torah. And the Rav Unterman gave this answer as well. That's his argument. Rav Wasner, in his Shevet Halevi Chelek Aleph, Kufchaf Aleph Sivkatan Beis, says no. He says it's not a matter of a difference in the law for the two cases. It's a matter of difference in Mitzius. It's the difference. It's a different type of a case. The case of the anus of the attacker, someone is coming to slice off your ear. This goes back to the case of the Radvaz Chelek Gimel Tshuva Tafrish Chav Zayin, talking about somebody who can save someone else's life by sacrificing his ear. The case there, someone is attacking you. He's going to slice off a limb. That's dangerous. It's not just dangerous to the limb. There's going to be bleeding. It's dangerous to the body of the person. And that's why everything is justified. Whereas here, we're talking about a broken hand. We're talking about a derabanan. Okay.